Samaveda Bhakti Vrindakita, Gaur Prindavan. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gaur Prabhupada. All glories to Sri Guru. Dati prati grinati guru makyati kritchati bhunte bojayate chaiva sandhavidim kriti lakshanam. Offering gifts in charity, accepting charitable gifts, revealing one's mind in confidence, inquiring confidentially, accepting prasad, offering prasad are the six symptoms of love shared by one divinity. Text 4. Krishna tiyasya viditam manasadriyeta jikshashki chetpratam. Pranati vishcha vajanta nisham shushu shaya vajana vignanam annayam annanyam annanyam annyanistani sunya ridham shicha sangalabdhya. One should mentally honor the devotee who chants the holy name of Lord Krishna. One should offer humble obeisances to the devotee who has undergone spiritual initiation, diksha, and is engaged in worshiping the deity. One should associate with and faithfully serve that pure devotee who has advanced in undeviated devotional service and whose heart is completely devoid of the propensity to criticize others. 6. Tristai svabhava janitara pusascha doshayana prakritatva minabhapta janasya pasyat gangam vasamna kalukudhuda pena pankar brahma dravatam apagachati niradharmain. Being situated in his original Krishna conscious position, a pure devotee does not identify with the body. Such a devotee should not be seen from a materialistic point of view. Indeed, one should overlook a devotee's having a body born in a low family, a body with a bad complexion, a deformed body, or a diseased or infirm body. According to ordinary vision, such imperfections may seem prominent in the body of a pure devotee, but despite such seeming defects, the body of a pure devotee cannot be polluted. It is exactly like the waters of the Ganges, which sometimes during the rainy season are full of bubbles, foam, and mud. The Ganges waters do not become polluted. Those who are advanced in spiritual understanding will bathe in the Ganges without considering the condition of the water. When Dhruva Maharaj was very angry at his stepmother and stepbrother and wanted vengeance, he went on the order of his mother, the advice of his mother, to the forest to search out Lord Narayana. And there he met Narada. And Narada said to him, if you want to stop all material miseries, you should be telling him. Anybody who would like to stop all material miseries? Anybody who would like to stop all material miseries? Anybody who would like me to come to you and want the miseries to increase? So Narada said, if you want to stop all material miseries, you should do what we say to him. It's related to today's topic, just in case you thought it was completely crazy by bringing this up. No? Oh? What are we looking at today? What is this topic in the nectar instruction today? How to? How to associate with devotees, with people. Because the first three verses, of course, there was something about association.
Janda Sangha and Sangha Tyaga. But the first few verses were mostly, how do I take care of myself? And these verses are how I deal with others. So how do I take care of myself? How do I deal with others? Then we're going to get into devotional service, really. I mean, of course, just cut that karma. We already have, we have to follow the previous acharyas and engage in the process of shravana kirtanam. But what we're really going to get into next week is, of course, Radha to Prema, text 7 and 8, and then 9 to 11 is what is the ultimate goal. So how to deal with others. So what did the Buddha say? You could conquer all material miseries by how you deal with others. You can conquer all material miseries by how you deal with others. He said, if you see someone superior, you should offer respect. If you see someone equal, you should become their friends. And if you see someone lower than you, you should try to elevate them. Now, generally, do materialistic people do that? No. There's one wonderful devotee in Mumbai who met Prabhupada many, many times. After Prabhupada left the planet, but he had many talks with Srila Prabhupada, and he's a big businessman, and he admitted that when he was talking with Prabhupada, he was looking for some weakness to try to exploit it. He said, in business, we try to find the weakness of the competition so we can exploit them. Isn't that how we deal generally in the world? That's how one country deals with another. Let me see where that country is weak so I have an advantage over them. This is what we're here for. We're here to lord it over others, to try to become God, but we're not a very nice God. So someone who's inferior to us, we try to exploit them. Someone who's equal to us, we try to find some way to push them down. The Prabhupada explains all this in his purport in the fourth canto. And the same with someone who's superior, we try to bring them down. What's wrong with them? And we see that it even happens, shocking, to those of us who join the Hare Krishna movement. Somehow when we walk in the door and, you know, put on the tilak and the beads and then it's not that immediately you start treating everybody properly. Of course, we each treat everybody properly. It's the others I'm talking about. But, you know, it's not necessarily that happens. You still find in the Hare Krishna movement this materialistic tendency of wanting to posit myself as supreme. If someone's lower than me, I want to keep them lower than me. And if someone's equal or higher, I want to pull them down. And we find here it's exactly the opposite. So learning this little secret, according to Narada, who I think is a pretty good authority, will relieve us of material miseries. And I'd like us to think, maybe by the end of the class, we can think as we go through this instruction of Rupa Goswami, to think, why, if we follow this, would our material miseries go away? Material miseries going away, by the way, doesn't necessarily mean that if you have a broken finger, you know, you look at it and it's healed. Krishna does that stuff sometimes. He does. I mean, there are cases where people say, Krishna, please heal me, and you know, you get healed. But that's not what we're talking about. How does Krishna say you get free of material miseries in the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita? Right? Controlling the mind. In other words, by transcending them, by not identifying with them, which is what, of course, we look at in text 5. Okay, so you ready to consider how you will get free of material miseries by following this? This advice of Narada given in that one verse has almost been expanded here by Rupa Goswami. So let's go over first, just a sort of an overview. So text 4 is the loving exchanges. There are 6 loving exchanges, and they really just deal with 3 things. What are they? Gifts? Prasadam? And confidences. Gifts, food, and confidences. And then the 6 are giving and taking. Each of them you're supposed to give, and you're supposed to take. All right. Then you might ask, I do this? Do I do this with everybody? Do I do it with everybody exactly the same? Sometimes the word discrimination has a bad reputation. Don't discriminate. Don't judge. You ever hear anybody say that? Well, that originally comes, of course, from the Bible, where Jesus says, as you judge others, you will also be judged according to that standard. How many of us are willing to be judged by the standard that we use to judge others? But Jesus is not saying don't have any discrimination. He's not saying, you know, go eat trash and sewage because you don't judge anything. That's not the point. So here is discrimination. You have to be discriminating. The whole last six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita are about discriminating according to the modes of material nature. You've got to discriminate. This is an ignorance. This is a passion. This is a goodness. This is a person in goodness, passion, ignorance. Everybody, who doesn't discriminate? Yeah, even if you really like the mode of ignorance, you're going to discriminate. Well, this is not ignorance. I'm not going to have anything to do with it. Who can live without that? The animals discriminate by nature. It's just, it's forced on them. Now, the cows here, if you gave them a piece of meat, they don't have the ability to choose it, really. And human beings have to discriminate. So what do you think that Jesus meant when he said about judging? That, you know, be careful how you judge others because you'll be judged the way you judge others. What do you think he meant? Some idea? I'm sorry?
We always think of the other mistake, we don't see looking at our mistake.
Yes, we see others' mistake, but not looking ours at our mistake. But what's sort of the thing that he's telling us not to do? He's telling us not to criticize. So can you discriminate without being critical? Is it possible to discriminate without being critical? Do you think that might have something to do with why treating people appropriately would help us to conquer the material miseries? Okay, let's think about that and let it kind of percolate a little bit. All right, so we discriminate but without being critical, and not being critical is a really important feature of these three verses. So text 5 tells us on what basis to discriminate. And text 6 tells us on what basis not to discriminate. So text 4 is, these are the loving exchanges. Three things, give and take, which makes 6. Then text 5 is, this is how you tell what kind of people to have these exchanges with at what level. And text 6 is, don't use this as a criteria. Why? Because people are going to tend to use the criteria in text 6, which is what? In text 6 he's saying what not to do. What do you know? How do you not discriminate? Based on the? On the body. So generally we discriminate based on the body, don't we? Here's someone who's like me. When I was just in Wellington, Krishnamurti had a book in the room, which is where I stayed, about the difference in communication styles between men and women. And it was, mostly the book was aimed at helping women in the workplace to try to speak to men in a style that men would be able to want to listen to. Anyway, the author, who's a psychologist, was making the point that we all trust someone who we think is similar to ourselves. And I was thinking about how in traveling, sometimes I go for long periods of time without meeting another American. And I really noticed it when I was at the airport in Shanghai. And there were some people in line ahead of me who were not only speaking American English, but they were speaking American English in a northeastern accent, which is where I'm from. And immediately I felt some kind of kinship with them. I felt like I could trust them. And it just struck me how odd it is that as soon as we think, I mean, I don't know these people, My point is, we tend to discriminate based on the body. Here's somebody like me. Here's someone I can connect. Oh, they have a different kind of body. Oh, no, I can't trust them. They have a different culture. They have a different, where there's something wrong with their body. Take six is taking the extreme example of somebody who's got something really wrong with their body. The kind of people where you sort of want to look at them and you're afraid to look at them. Isn't it? Right? So don't discriminate like that. Okay. But that's our tendency. Remember that it's our tendency. That's sort of our default value. And it happens even unconsciously. Oh, here's someone like me. Here's someone around my age, or somebody of my gender, or somebody from my country, or, somebody from my part of the country. Like, the Indians are fine. Oh, are you South Indian or are you Bengali? My part, or my caste, or even my part of the caste. One devotee girl was telling me how her parents were really opposing her marriage to a devotee boy, because even though he was from the same part of India and the same caste, he wasn't from the same part of the caste. And so her father refused to come to the wedding. So again, this is a default thing. Just automatically go in that direction. All right. Ready? So the six loving exchanges. What is the main gift that Prabhupada says here that we're supposed to give? The holy name. And therefore Srila Prabhupada speaks at length in the purport about the holy name. And one should also receive the holy name. And of course we're doing this. This is kirtan. That is what kirtan is. Giving and receiving the holy name. The leader is giving and receiving, and the responders are giving and receiving. And of course, prasadam, that's pretty easy. I give you prasadam, I accept prasadam. Most of us don't have a problem accepting prasadam. If it's some kind of prasadam that for some reason you can't accept, what should you do? At least. Take just a little, at least offer some respect. And then what about revealing our mind in confidence? What does that mean? Does that mean I just take all the gunk that's in my mind and throw it at you? I assume that most of us have nasty thoughts enter our mind. Is that true? So does it mean we just put those out there? What does this mean? Revealing our mind in confidence and inquiring confidentially.
Sometimes people will be
So talking about what you want to do, getting confirmation of what you're doing, and you make the point about revealing your mind to someone you trust, which of course brings us to text 5. To whom do you reveal your mind? Prabhupada talks about asking confidentially about advancing your Krishna consciousness. What happens if we don't reveal our doubts, our struggles, our difficulties, and our questions? What happens if we just sort of keep them so we can make it socially in the movement? So everybody will think that we're all together. What do you think happens after some time?
You stop progressing.
Yeah, you stop progressing. And what often happens is you leave. You see this happen. I saw this happen in the marriage of a very good friend of mine. They had been married for about 10 years. They had 5 children. And the man thought it was a perfect marriage. He was completely happy. He thought his wife was completely happy. And one day she said, I'm leaving. He said, what do you mean you're leaving? And then she had this list, mentally. She had a list. 5 miles. of all the complaints that she had for 10 years. It was like one of these dormant volcanoes that everybody thinks is sleeping, you know, and all of a sudden the village is destroyed. It wasn't really very funny, poor boy. And I said to him, you've got to reveal your mind. It was too late, you know, by that time it was. The whole sky was covered with smoke. And it went from someone who appeared to be, oh, yes, I'm happy, everything's fine. So we find that Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita is revealing his doubts. We were speaking about this at the school the other day. How nowadays in India the system of education is modeled after the British medieval system, where the teacher says and you all just repeat in unison. This is a microphone. Everybody say microphone. And that's all the teaching. And you can go class after class after class, and every teacher, that's all they're saying. This is nose. Everybody say nose.
Nose.
Yes, nose. You're looking at one video of a teacher like this. It's like this, it's like this, it's like this. Okay, does everybody understand? All the kids say, yes, sir. Okay, good. So what we find in the Bhagavad Gita, it's not like that. That isn't actually the traditional Indian system, by the way. That's something the British imposed. And now even in the UK, they don't teach like that. But Arjuna expresses his doubts, doesn't he? He says, I can't follow this equivocal system of yoga. What's equivocal mean? Equivocal means, well, you're saying this thing, and now you're saying the opposite thing. That's a pretty strong thing to say to your teacher, especially if your teacher happens to be God. Why are you giving me equivocal instructions? You say karma, sannyasa, and then you say buddhi yoga. You say give up activity, and then you say buddhi yoga. Okay, fine, that sounds like I give up activity, I just do buddhi yoga. But then you tell me to fight. It doesn't look like buddhi yoga and karma, sannyasa. What are you talking about? Why are you giving me equivocal instructions? And then when Krishna's explaining dhyana yoga, what does Arjuna say? He says, this system of yoga appears impractical. What kind of a thing to say to your teacher, especially if your teacher is God? My dear teacher, you've given me opposite instructions, and now you're telling me something impractical. I can't do this, Chanchalahima not Krishna. It's impossible. Why are you giving me an impossible system? And then what doubt does Arjuna express at the end of the sixth chapter? Which is a very big doubt among people who come to the Hare Krishna movement. It wasn't just Arjuna's doubt. What was his doubt?
What happens if I'm not successful?
What happens if I fail? I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands, but do any of you ever worry about that? Suppose I don't make it. What will happen if I fail? Look at that, Prabhu. He didn't make it. Oops. If you didn't make it, how am I going to make it? And if I fail, well, I've spent all my 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s. Now what am I going to do? I'm too old to go back out in the world and, you know, get a job as an IBM CEO. There's a famous poem of this man who said, I wanted to gain knowledge, and after I gained knowledge, I wanted to marry a girl as beautiful as a demigoddess, you know, as intelligent as something or other. And then I did this and that and the other thing, and then I was too old to find a girl who was as beautiful as a goddess. So we think like that, you know, I'll spend all of my time in the Hare Krishna movement, I'll fail, I won't become pure devotee, and then all my material opportunities will be gone. And that was our journey, that was our goodness down. I'll put my energy into yoga, and I'll fail. And then, I won't have anything. I won't have anything materially, and I won't have anything spiritually. That was his doubt, and he expressed that to Krishna. He asked Krishna. We were just studying the 12th chapter. What did Arjuna ask Krishna? Beginning of 12th chapter.
What's the best process?
Yes, what's the best process? Personalism or impersonalism? So this is revealing one's mind in confidence. That one brings up one's questions, one doubts. Even if the doubts seem embarrassing, that doesn't mean you have to bring up all your doubts in front of all the devotees in the class. But somebody to whom one can reveal oneself, I don't know if I'm going to make it. I might be wasting my life. What's going to happen? And this example is shown there in the Shastra. Isn't it? It's expressing one's mind confidentially. And one should be willing also to help others in a confidential manner. But expressing one's mind confidentially does not mean, you know, this, I'm thinking this nasty thought and this nasty thought, all the gory details. Confidential exchange doesn't mean that we have to be witness to a horror movie. Okay? It doesn't mean you vomit at the feet of the person whom you're revealing your mind. So it has some discrimination. I think there's a few points I wanted to make. I'm going to spend most of the time on the other two. There's a few things I thought were really interesting from the purports. Prabhupada says, even in ordinary social activities, these six types of dealings between two loving friends are absolutely necessary. So, if we want to know, Prabhupada's giving us here, Rupa Goswami is giving us here, psychology. If you want to love somebody, whether it's your friend, you know, your buddy in the Brahmacharya Ashram, or whether it's your wife, or whether it's your parents, or whether it's your job, how do you do it? These six loving exchanges. And part of it is accepting. Part of it is accepting. Sometimes we think love just means to give, but love also means to accept. So Prabhupada says they're absolutely necessary. You cannot have a loving relationship without these six kinds of exchanges. We could probably form a whole counseling protocol based on this verse. And Prabhupada says the International Society for Krishna Consciousness has been established to facilitate these six kinds of loving exchanges between devotees. I mean, why go through all the trouble of having a society? Was it a lot of trouble to build this building? How many years did it take to build this building? 20 or something? And still not paid for it.
Will be.
All right, so a lot of trouble. I bet a lot of people in this room here went to a lot of trouble to make sure this building is standing, or a lot of trouble to maintain the grounds. Right? Maintaining buildings, that's a lot of trouble. It's a lot of difficulty. Why not just, you know, go to Radhika and sit in the chant Hare Krishna? Why are we forming a whole society? Or why not just everybody in their own house with their own practice? To facilitate these six loving exchanges between devotees. That's what it's for. Okay. And the Prabhupada says the life of the Krishna conscious society is nourished by these six types of loving exchanges among the members. So if we want to have real life, then we need to engage in these six exchanges. And then Prabhupada, we were talking about how he said that the greatest gift is giving the holy name, giving Krishna consciousness. So this is sort of an aside in a sense, but I really like this section. Something that Prabhupada, of course, says over and over and over again, but such a nice thing to hear. The understanding of Krishna consciousness is innate in every living entity, and it is already developed to some extent when a living entity takes a human body. Pure love for Krishna is eternally established in the hearts of living entities. It is not something to be gained from another source. When the heart is purified by hearing and chanting, the living entity naturally awakens. So what's wonderful about these kind of statements is that really Krishna consciousness is already there in each of us. It's already there. It already exists. The pure love for Krishna is already there. It's not something artificial. It's not something to be gained by practice. It's not something, Prabhupada said, that we get from another source. It's already there. It's part of us. It's something like, Prabhupada uses the word here, awakens. Udaya is the Bengali. To get up. So just like I assume last night all of us slept, and obviously all of us woke up. So when you're sleeping, you're dreaming so many things, and you wake up, and oh, this is who I am. It's already there. That's exactly what Krishna consciousness is. It's already there. Oh, I'm just trying to wake ourselves up. Prabhupada's also talking about in the same context that Krishna consciousness is already there, and it's a little bit obvious in any human being. The way he gives evidence for this is that every human society has some system of religion. So he makes that point. So religion is a special function of human society, and it constitutes the distinction between human society and animal society. Animal society has no church, mosque, or religious system. In all parts of the world, however downtrodden human society may be, there is some system of religion. When a religious system develops and turns into love of God, it is successful. So the evidence that there's some innate Krishna consciousness is that all human beings have some inclination towards religion, or you could say some inclination towards some underlying philosophy of life, understanding what is the meaning and the purpose of life. I mean, one may conclude, I don't know if I've told you guys this before, but we had a devotee lent us a video for our group called America that was giving the evolutionary point of view, and the scientist gets out of the beginning and he says, we can understand the origin of the universe by looking at the sky, stars, and therefore we can conclude that the origin of everything, is what he said, is a cold, impersonal machine. But the point is that a human being is looking for answers. This is the natural, this is how you can see the little spark of Krishna consciousness. That even if somebody concludes that the origin of everything is a cold, impersonal machine, how could you imagine someone saying that about you?
You're just a cold, impersonal machine.
You know, how bad you would feel, how offended you would feel, how hurt you would feel, you know? Therefore, we say Krishna is really offended by the impersonalists and mind when he's an atheist. You know, he has feelings. Like it says when Hiranyaksha was criticizing him, that Lord Varaha's feelings were hurt. But anyway, my point is that persons are, they're looking for some higher philosophy. And this is our evidence that Krishna consciousness is innate, which should give us some hope and some faith. It's already there. It's already there. It's not like if I want to become an Olympic gymnast. You know, that's not innate to the body. That has to be developed, isn't it? It's not something natural for the body. Whereas Krishna consciousness is just that. All right. Now we're going to go on to text 5. Who do we have these exchanges with? And because Rupa Goswami has already said Janasangha and Sangha Tyaga in texts 2 and 3, he's assuming that we know that we don't have these loving exchanges with people who are not devotees. Now, as we talked about last week, Bhaktivinoda Thakura makes the point that we all deal with people who are not devotees, and the difference was, anybody remember? He gave a word. Affection. Does that mean that we're cold-hearted towards people who are not devotees? No. How could we be? In one sense, every living entity is a devotee. Aham bija pradha pita, Krishna's the father of everyone. Everyone is Krishna's part and parcel. That's one of the reasons why we don't eat animals. They're not acting as devotees. Anybody see a chicken chant Hare Krishna? But still, we respect them because they're part and parcel of Krishna. They're Krishna's children. Maybe Krishna's rebellious children, but they're still Krishna's children. If any of you have a rebellious child, you still wouldn't want somebody to hurt them. Oh, they're rebellious, that's okay. You can shoot them. So we have a kind of affection for all living entities, as we were speaking about last week. Otherwise, how can you preach? Why would you preach? If I don't like somebody, if they're not presently acting as a devotee, what would be the impetus for preaching? I'm preaching out of affection and compassion. I suppose the impetus could be pride and arrogance. I know more than you.
You are a fool. I want to prove you wrong so you can agree with me.
That could be a motive for preaching also. But that's not a very pleasing motive for preaching. The real motive for preaching should be a kind of affection. However, the point is that if we have to engage in some of these exchanges with non-devotees, it should be officially. Now, there shouldn't really be an intimate connection with non-devotees. I shouldn't be feeling, oh, this non-devotee is really my friend, I can trust them, I can rely on them. That's very dangerous. And Prabhupada makes pretty amazing statements in this purport. And amazing in the sense that it's not how we live in ISKCON, where he says that only very advanced people can accept anyone's contribution, and we should not accept food or charity from materialistic persons. He said if you eat food cooked by materialistic persons, your mind becomes wicked. Okay, we all know that. At least there was a time in the Hare Krishna movement when we all knew that. I don't think that's so much known anymore. So I'm just going to repeat that. If we eat food cooked by materialistic persons, our mind becomes wicked, and I may be a very unpopular person for saying that, but I'm just repeating what's in the purport. And Prabhupada says that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said it, so I think that's pretty good. Yeah. And I no longer assume anything's made by devotees. I used to. I used to assume that if I go to a Hare Krishna temple or a Hare Krishna function, or if someone who's a Hare Krishna devotee gives me something to eat, that it was cooked by devotees. And I have reason no longer to assume that. Although asking is sometimes very difficult. I was staying at the home of this one lovely, lovely devotee in India, and every morning she was offering me cornflakes. You know what do they call that? On the underside of the world. And bread. And you know, in India, people don't usually make bread. So quite in India, you sort of assume that it's bought. So every day I was refusing, and after a while she said, you're the first farmer that doesn't eat these things. And I was thinking, farmer, well, you eat these things too. So, and I was at a temple once, Hare Krishna, I was at a temple once, where I saw the boys go to a bakery and buy bread for Lord Nityananda's feast. And I was just like, whoa. So anyway, we used to know that in the Hare Krishna movement. I know it's not a very popular thing anymore. And I've been to programs where 100% of the food that's being distributed was bought from the outside. You say, well, that's a nice cake. Do you have anybody that talent in your community? Like, no, you're able to order vegetarian cakes from that shop. But what's really interesting is Prabhupada says not even to accept any kind of charity from materialistic people. Prabhupada says it, and it's not something that we've ever thought of. Generally, in the Hare Krishna movement, we don't ask people, if somebody came forward, you know, someone went up to the temple board here and said, you know, I'd really like to give you $10 million to develop a project. I don't think we'd say, are you a journalist? Do you have some personalistic leanings? How strict are your spiritual rights? We would probably just say, thank you very much. Right? And of course, in the previous purport, Prabhupada was talking about how we're giving out books and we're accepting donations. We don't go to the people and say, I'm not sure if I can accept your donation for this book. So what do you think that means? Not becoming addicted to them. That's something very dangerous. This also, of course, relates to Raghunath Das Goswami. Know the story of Raghunath Das Goswami? A very rich man. His uncle and father together, there's only one boy, him. And they were very wealthy, and they were a kind of Vaishnavas. Prakriti Bhagavats, which we'll talk about with this verse. And he left home to serve Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And at first, his father sent all his servants to take care of him and cook for him. And he thought, okay. And then he was inviting Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to take for so. You know, I've got servants and I've got food, I'll invite the Lord. His father sent me money, and I thought, I'm not going to take my father's money anymore. And so he started getting the order right. He started then going to the gate outside the temple, hoping for charity. And then he thought, this is just like I'm a prostitute. It's like I'm looking, who's going to give me some food? Who's going to give me some food? Is that a food-giving person? Sometimes people looking for donations for the Hare Krishna women also think like that. Do you have money? Do you have money? You don't have money? Okay, I'll talk to you. You have money? Okay, I'll talk to you. Right? Not a very nice way to think about people. So he said, that's not very good. And he started going to the charity booths and just getting food from there. And then he decided that he would just take the rice. They're just like all of us, you know, if there's some gold prasadam, what do? We throw it to the birds and the cows. Right? Maybe city folks don't do that, but we here on the farm. Like the other day, two different devotees brought me lunch. So the Pukiko's got some lunch. So, you know, if something's old, especially if it becomes old and you can't distribute it anymore to people, you throw it to the animals. But there it was so rotten that even the cows wouldn't eat it. It was rejected by the cows. And he went and took that rice and he washed it. And was left with some hard portion and he put some salt on it. And that's what he ate. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was so happy that he went and took some from his hand. He said, why are you keeping all the nectar to yourself? But anyway, why did Raghunathdas Goswami refuse his father's money? Why did he do that? He was using it for Chaitanya's service. Why did he do that? We can get addicted, like you were saying. I saw in one temple, if I do this so I don't identify the place. Anyway, there was a temple where there was a wealthy person who was regularly giving a lot of money to this temple and was paying salaries so that the head of the different departments, the president of the temple, the person in charge of the restaurant, the person in charge of the shop, all these people were getting a salary from this wealthy person who lived at a distance. Can anyone guess what kind of things started happening in this temple? Yeah, they started taking advantage of his wealth. They would create false projects for him to give money to. They would create projects that looked like projects and they weren't real. I saw several interesting times like that. What else do you think happened? What happens if you think if you're running a shop and how much money you get paid depends on an automatic salary being given by somebody from a distance? So-and-so who lives, you know, 1,000 miles away and who never sees that the shop is clean, well, why should I keep a nice shop? And that's what happened. You go in the shop and the stuff was literally rotting and full of worms and bugs. And people running the restaurant didn't care if any customers came or whether the food was nice. And the town president didn't care. You know, it was very interesting. And after being there for a while, I thought, what it means. So one should be careful personally. Prabhupada said, not everybody can engage everything in Krishna service. So we can take from anybody and engage it in Krishna service, but be careful about taking something for yourself. There's a warning. Be careful about taking something for yourself. And even be careful about how you're engaging in Krishna service. Be careful. And one can become compromised. One can start thinking, instead of trying to please Krishna and Guru, I'm trying to please this materialistic person. You start molding yourself. And we see this sometimes, devotees who are getting money from their parents or this or that. They start molding their life to please the person who's giving them money. Just had a very interesting discussion with a devotee who was complaining that even though she was probably the most unqualified person in this one on a particular subject matter, that her advice on that subject was being ignored. So I made a list of all of the ways that a person might be respected for their opinion. You could be a man, you could be from India, you could be from a Vaishnava family, you could have a degree of the subject matter, you could have written books on it, I made a whole list. And I said, even people who are like that sometimes are not respected. And she wrote back and she said, no, the main reason that people are listened to and respected is if they have money. And have we seen temples, maybe some of you haven't, but those of you who've traveled a bit, where the spiritual content of the temple and the spiritual program is compromised because of whom they're getting the donations from? Have you seen that? Have you seen that in your travels? Yeah. We're giving you, 50,000 a year, 100,000 a year, 200,000 a year. And all of a sudden, we start having different kinds of festivals and different kinds of food and even different deities. Do you know that? All of a sudden, interesting deities appear in the temple. Why are these personalities on our altar? I wish I was joking. So why don't you be very, very careful. And the tendency is so strong that if someone's giving money, you want to please them. Just like this. And so therefore, I want you to be very careful. Okay. Now, that may not necessarily mean that we refuse people's money, but it may mean that we have to be very careful how it's utilized and whether or not we become dependent on them. All right, let's look at the three different kinds of devotees. Because there's a large section in this purport about not having these exchanges with materialistic persons, so that's what we just talked about, right? Okay. Now we're going to talk about the three kinds of persons with whom we can have these sort of intimate dealings. And there's, we've all heard of this, there's the Kanista, Madhyama, and Uttama. So, Kanista. Nista means fixed. Nista. Fixed. And Kanista means not fixed. Madhyama literally means just middle. And Uttama. Tama means ignorance. Uttama, above ignorance. Now just see all the non-enviousness, if you can remember from the Niyamagraha portion of last week. Bhaktivinoda Thakur talked about the different steps and how there's different rules on each step. I'm sure I must have mentioned it. If I didn't, I'll mention it now. But on the very top step of pure Uttama Bhakti, the only positive rule is Krishna Prema and the only negative rule is don't envy. So here we see this non-enviousness. If someone even says Hare Krishna one time, you respect them. Once in their life they say Krishna's name. Well, let's go to the Cinerama. You respect them. Somebody saying Krishna's name. Immediately. On Facebook recently, somebody wrote me a message. When you were a little girl, did you go to camp for mom? I think that, my wife was in your group. And I thought, oh yeah, I did go to camp for mom. All these people saying camp for mom. So immediately you respect them. They're saying their holy name. And what do you do with people who are inferior to you? You try to? Bring them up. That's non-enviousness. Enviousness is I keep them down. Non-enviousness, I try to bring them up. I try to make them better than I am. Just like a loving parent wants the children to be better than they are. That's their desire. They want their children to excel. But that's the way Krishna is. in order for me to be great, I have to reject Krishna and try to put myself in the center. I'm just reading what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was telling Sanatana Goswami, that the residents of Vaikuntha have the six opulences in full. He uses the word purna in full. Now, obviously, no jiva has the opulences quite at the level of Krishna. But the point is that Krishna is giving all of his pure devotees his own opulences. He's not envious. You want to be God of the universe? Be Lord Brahma. Be God of the universe. You want to be like me? Be my equal. Have a form like me. Have opulences like me. Who of us is so non-envious? Which one of us would be happy for all of our friends to have opulences equal to ourselves? That's Krishna's mood. Even he likes the devotees to be his superior. Here he is with Yasoda. When you take people who are lower, you try to elevate them, not that you keep them down. But if a person who's lower than you is not of proper behavior, you respect them from a distance. So this is a very big question. You know, what do I do with devotees who really aren't behaving at the proper standard? You respect them from a distance. You don't become their intimate associate. You can still give them some prasada or give them a holy name, whatever, but careful. Take some care. And Prabhupada mentioned to this purport as an example, he gives it several examples. One is the sanchas. People who aren't following any of the regular principles, they're openly having those, they're saying their illicit sex is worship of Krishna, taking intoxication. Prabhupada gives them as an example of devotees that he respected within the mind, because he said they're certainly devotees. And he gives the example of George Harrison, who mentions all but by name. And Prabhupada says, we give him all respect. So just see, Srila Prabhupada is giving all respect to George Harrison. That is the mood. And we should note how the lower are called not only Kanista, but Prakriti Bhaktas. What does Prakriti mean? Prakriti means? Material nature. A Prakriti Bhakta means a materialistic devotee. We'll get into the definition in a minute. So those people I keep at a distance. Of course, I can't keep them entirely at a distance. Because, well, suppose I'm the Prakriti Bhakta. Ooh. If all of the advanced devotees keep me at a distance, then I'm not going to be able to advance, am I? I'm going to be stuck. I'm only going to be able to associate with other Prakriti Bhaktas. Therefore, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, we call such persons Prakriti Bhaktas. We still call them Bhaktas, so the advanced devotees have some leeway to associate with them. So therefore, even if someone's a materialistic devotee, try to elevate them as much as you can. And if you can't, then keep distance. One has to also be humble. Here's somebody I can't help. And that should come from humility. Not, here's somebody who's so low, they're such a great personality like myself, well, no, I don't bother to associate. Yes, there I am, more natural. There are Prakriti. And I am Utila. Or at least Utila. But now it should be the mentality that, whoa, you know, I'm really fallen and weak, and if I associate with this person, I'm not going to be able to make it. I'm going to have difficulty. I'm not strong enough. Just like you're talking about taking things from materialistic people. Why don't you be honest and say, you know, I don't think I'm strong enough to accept this. I don't think I'm strong enough for this association. Not that you say that to the person. That's what you're thinking. You know, this person is so materialistic that if I try to help them, I'm going to equal them. Out of humility. You know, you start talking to somebody, this happened to me one Sunday, this is why you start talking to me, and after a couple of minutes, I realized that her entire conversation was consisting of blasphemy Vaishnavas. And I thought, you know, I really don't think I can help this person.
I just don't have the strength. If I hang out with her for another 5 seconds, I'm going to fall down. And I just, it's nice that she's chanting Hare Krishna, and it's nice that she's sitting here eating prasadam, but I just can't. I can't do it. Okay, then with the Majjhima devotees, or someone that you're saying, they'll be make friends with. And those who are higher than you, you serve them. So you see this all non-enviousness. I try to elevate, I have friendship. Friendship means I'm not trying to put you down. And higher, I serve. Okay, now what are these three kinds of devotees? How are they defined? Now this is really tricky because they're defined different ways in different places. And those definitions do not all match. So it's something like, and I've given this example before, if you're talking about the growth of a child to an adult, what sort of ways could you measure maturity?
Physical character.
Physical. What else?
Mental.
Mental. What else?
Behavior.
Which might, you may say social maturity. So physical, mental, social, and what?
Intellectual.
And what?
Emotional.
Emotional. Okay. Do those all coincide? Do they all match? If you made a list of the different levels of physical maturity and the different levels of mental and the different levels of intellectual and social and emotional, are you all with me? We have the different lists. Could you find a one-to-one match between all of them? If someone has a certain level of physical maturity, are they necessarily the same at a certain level of mental, intellectual, emotional, social maturity? No. Okay. So those are different ways of describing the process of maturation. And you can't just match them up. Is that clear? So there's also different ways of describing the kanista, the majjhima, and the uttama, and they don't all correspond to each other. So in other words, someone may be a kanista by one way of looking at it and a majjhima by another way of looking at it, because you're looking at different things. So it's not that someone who's a kanista is going to be kanista in all areas. If I say, oh, that person is really immature, does that necessarily mean they're physically immature? Maybe, and maybe not. They might be immature in just one area. Haven't you? And people like that. You know, there's someone who's physically mature, mentally, intellectually, emotionally, and socially, they're really immature. It happens. So do keep that in mind, because I find sometimes we want to make everything all neat little boxes and put everything in a little box, and it just isn't like that. Which also gives us some indication that what we're choosing with whom we associate, we may associate differently with the same person in different areas, because a person may be more advanced in some area than in others. So there may be some ways that we can have a higher level of association and some ways that we can have another kind of association. And it also means we shouldn't be confused if we see somebody who's at a very high level in certain areas and not at such a high level in other areas. Our development doesn't happen like this in all areas. We see that in school, right, Monica? Some kids are really good in language and not really good in math, and some kids it's reversed, and it's just the way it is. And can we see that in ourselves? Are there some areas in which, you know, we really have it together, or we have a lot of faith, and then there's other areas that we're really struggling in, and some areas it's sort of somewhere in the middle. And just as a little aside, best friends are those who can see that in you and like you anyway, isn't it? The person with whom you can really reveal your mind in confidence is someone who can see you as a holistic person, who doesn't just see the parts of you that are really together and say, oh, you're so together, oh, you're wonderful, or who doesn't just see the parts of you where you're really struggling to go, oh, you're a really nasty person. And that's how we should also strive to be. That's how we want to be seen. Isn't it only want to be seen as real people? And that's also how we should strive to see others as well. Sadly. All right, what are the different ways of defining? How is Rupa Goswami defining in his verse the kanista, the majjhima, and the uttama?
By chanting.
Somewhat by chanting, yes. He
He's saying that one who is chanting is one who's just chanting, and Prabhupada tells others received first initiation, and second is one who's the middle of the Vajra is one who's received Diksha, second initiation, and is worshiping the deity, and the Uttama is one who
is giving. One is giving.
One is giving Diksha. That's not your own test. Devoid of the propensity to criticize others. Could we speak for a week on that? Why does Rupa Goswami pick this one thing? If you have no propensity to criticize others, that means you must be free from envy. Why do we criticize others? We're like that Vrikasura. You know that Vrikasura? Remember that Vrikasura? He was cutting off pieces of his body and throwing them in fire to please Lord Shiva. And finally he was going to cut off his head. And Prabhupada said he thought that he could live forever by killing everybody else. And you read that and you think, huh? If he killed everybody else, he would still die. But we all do that, or at least most of us. I think the way that I'm going to become God is by criticizing everybody else. That if I can see how everyone else has some fault, then that will elevate me. Does that make any sense? Is that logical? Is that logical? Yes? No? Maybe so? Not sure. Falling asleep? So even if all of you, even if everyone in this room has a certain fault, does that mean I'm free of it? No. But that's why we criticize. To try to cross ourselves as supreme. And we may criticize verbally, but at least mentally. So do we have a bee mind or a fly mind? Where can I find the open sore? Right. So this is Rupa Goswami's. Someone who's chanting, someone who's second initiated worshiping the deity, and somebody who doesn't. They don't just not criticize, they're devoid of the propensity. They have no inclination. Bhaktivinoda Bhaktiloka, we're talking about Jadasandha and Santityaga, says that one should not talk about others at all. Well, now then he says, of course, in household life, sometimes you have to talk about other people. In household life and in business. And then he says that a teacher has to talk about others in order to show an example. He gives the example of Krishna, the 16th chapter, who says that the divine persons are like this and the demons are like this. He says, otherwise people cannot understand something just theoretically. You have to give some specific example. And then, as the chapter is going on, at one point he says, something like, with great regret, I have to make this point about others. So even the tendency to talk about others, even to praise others, just this tendency to talk about others, to be absorbed in others, because the mood is often in others. Just a little something to think about. Other ways of defining the, what are other ways given in the scriptures, which probably refers to most of them in this purport? What are some other ways of defining the kanisthama jamanitama?
Level of faith.
Level of faith. And that, where is that explained? What shastra? In the Bhagavatam of Kanto and Kitchen Chaitamita, which then manifested as the Bhakti Samhita Sindhu, where Rupa Goswami is describing the levels as levels of faith. And he's particularly talking about those as levels of faith in Shastra, and he's there particularly talking about that as qualification, as adhikar, for taking a Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, because Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti is dependent on the Shastra. Raghavendra Bhakti is not dependent on the Shastra. Raghavendra Bhakti, you just love Krishna. It doesn't matter that Krishna says Ahamsarvasya, you know. You just love Krishna because you love Krishna. It's not some kind of rule. But in Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, one is trying to serve Krishna and develop affection for Krishna because it says in the Shastra that I should, and therefore my degree of qualification for serving Krishna is directly connected to my degree of faith in the Shastra. If I don't have faith in the Shastra when it says to worship Krishna, then I'm not going to worship Krishna very well. Right? It's like, how much do you trust your map? If you don't trust your map, you're not going to follow the instructions. How much do you trust the person who you've asked for directions? Okay, what are some other ways of describing Kanishtha Rajana and yes?
Degree of devotional service?
Can you claim it? Kanishtha is only interested in serving the deity, so there we're finding the Kanishtha just thinks about serving the deity and doesn't deal nicely with devotees, with anybody. The Vajra has four kinds of dealings, one with God, one with the other devotees, one with innocent and one with atheists. So with God there's prema, it's mentioned the word prema. With God there's prema, there's love. With the other devotees there's friendship, according to the six loving exchanges. With the innocent you're trying to help them, and you avoid the demons. Again, out of humility, not out of pride. That I'm too weak to associate with the demons, I can't help them. And the Uttama is a great preacher. And of course, Prabhupada talks about that, and there's where he says, when a neophyte devotee is actually initiated and engaged in devotional service by the orders of a spiritual master, he should be accepted immediately as a bona fide Vaishnava and obeisance, he should be offered unto him. Then he makes this interesting statement. Out of many such Vaishnavas who are initiated and serving the deity, one may be found to be very seriously engaged in the service of the Lord and strictly following all the regular principles, chanting the prescribed number of rounds on yoga beads, and always thinking of how to expand the Krishna consciousness movement. One at all, maybe. Interesting. Seems like there's many, or that most are like that. But are most really like that over time? Yesterday, I was talking to one devotee about, you know, people in such and such country after some time tend to sort of get lax. I said, no, everywhere. Not just in that country. In all countries. But after a while, people start saying that. Four good rounds is better than 16 bad rounds. Anyway, does that make any sense? Now, first of all, if you can chant four good rounds, then at least out of your 16, four of them can be good, right? Is that right? Four good or 16 bad. Well, if you can chant four good. And 12 bad. Why do you think this is four good or 16 bad? Anyways, you hear people say things like that. Oh, you know. And pretty soon it becomes one. Pretty soon it becomes one mantra. Oh, it's eating food cooked by non-devotees thing, you know, it's too difficult. I got a job and I got this and that. Oh, it's a codicy. You know, the real codicy is fasting from water and sleep, so why should I do any things? We're not doing the real thing anyway. Oh. Yeah, we got this regular principle, but really, this sort of just means that. This isn't really illicit because we've been living together for a couple of years. Yeah, imagine. So with this we see, I'm sorry, frankly, more than not, that people are enthused and then after a while they say, no, about all this stuff. I'll still be a devotee, sort of, kind of. Yeah. Like, so about other times, how to avoid getting to that place or how to get out of that place. I'm not going to talk about that today. And then always thinking of how to expand the Krishna consciousness movement. Now, by the way, when neophytes read this, they tend to think, yes, that's me. I am very strictly engaged in the service of the Lord. I am strictly following all the regular principles, training, prescribed number of rounds and job beats, and I am always thinking of how to expand the Krishna conscious movement. Well, therefore, I am into my way. Exactly. One of the keys to this, first of all, is longevity. Not that I've been doing that for a month or a year. And the other thing looking at this is, what is one really always thinking about?
What's up?
This takes a little honest introspection, my dear friends. And I remember going to some place to do some preaching program, and the first thing I asked the devotees who picked me up at the airport is, where am I going to stay? What time is prasadam? Then I asked about the preaching. And I thought, what am I really thinking about? What am I really thinking about? So often we think first, okay, where is it going to be a nice situation for me? And then, what service can I do? How many of us genuinely put the service first? Don't artificially imitate things, people. But this is some way of gauging what our position is. What are we really always thinking about? Always. Always thinking. Obviously, all of us sometimes think of how to expand the Krishna consciousness movement. But what is our most attention? Just on this particular level, the kanista is seen in every religious system. And there are some religious systems that are almost entirely kanista. When we say just worshiping the deity in the temple, it means very temple or church or mosque fixated. That religion means going to a place of worship and having a particular ritual, and then I go and, bomb buildings. That's a really low level of kanista. But, or I go to my church, and Jesus, and then we go downstairs and have chicken dinner. So that's kanista. That's a prakriti bhakta. Very low level. Yes, I worship God. God is wonderful, and I don't know how to treat other living entities. Or I'm nice to everybody who's also a Black Baptist, but I'm mean to everybody else. I'm nice to everyone else who's Irish, and I'm mean to everybody else. Something like that. I don't know how to deal properly with other living entities, although I worship God. And this is a way we can explain to people how we're non-sectarian. That just like there's many different places all teaching mathematics, but some are teaching on a very low level, and some are teaching on a very high level. Some places you get a PhD in mathematics, and some places it's just a nursery school and you're learning 1 + 1 = 2. But sometimes there are 10-year-olds who function at a PhD level of mathematics, even though they're in a primary school, and some people in the PhD program are acting like 5-year-olds. As Marge was saying yesterday, people go to the universities just to drink and smoke and have lots of sex. They're not really getting an education. So even in some very elementary systems of education, where the system itself is very much on the prakriti platform, we find sometimes some little bhaktas appear in such systems. And we find that even in a system teaching Uttama Bhakti, there are people who are prakriti bhaktas. So it's not that just because the system is elevated that all the persons are elevated. But anyway, that's one way of defining the prakriti bhakti. There's a few other definitions in here that I thought were of particular interest. Prabhupada says the Uttama Adhikari, or highest devotee, is one who is very advanced in devotional service. He's not interested in blaspheming others. His heart is completely clean, and he has attained the realized state of unalloyed Krishna consciousness. So he's realized it. It's not just theoretical. He's realized he's not the body, unalloyed. It's not mixed up with anything else. Another thing Prabhupada says is that If you are carefully avoiding the ten offenses, you can certainly be gradually elevated to the point of understanding that there is no difference between the holy name of the Lord and the Lord himself. One who has reached such an understanding should be very much respected by unified devotees. So this is another indication of who's an ultimate devotee. Someone who's realized that the holy name is Krishna. Not just an intellectual understanding, yes, the one who is Krishna, but as soon as they say the name Krishna, they're realizing that here's Krishna. And we'll end this part by just saying that Prabhupada says, we can see from practical experience that there are different types of Vaishnavas. So again, this is a practical thing one must discriminate. Now I'm just going to briefly go over text 6. Text 6 is Rupa Goswami saying, don't discriminate on the basis of the body, and he's giving the most extreme example of somebody who's deformed. We were talking earlier about how we tend to trust people who are like ourselves, who are similar to ourselves. And the thing that's most dissimilar is someone who has some sort of gross deformity. We tend to think of them as the most other, you know, a bad complexion, someone who's really ugly or really deformed in some way. We tend to keep some distance from such people and not trust them. Rupa Goswami is saying, even in such a circumstance, doesn't matter. That's not the criteria. What to speak of, Prabhupada gives in his purport, lesser ways of difference. Somebody has, you know, they're born in India, or they're born in Europe, or they're born in New Zealand, or they're born in China, or they're this or that. Of course, there's some, this is a very, one of the heaviest purports in Prabhupada's books, and a purport that Prabhupada's godbrothers weren't exactly very happy with. And Prabhupada saying, you know, you shouldn't criticize a devotee. And of course, Prabhupada, you know, he felt some, again, just like Krishna feels pain when he's blasphemed, so also the devotees feel pain when they're criticized. That's natural. And Prabhupada was just painful. He went out and did his spiritual master's mission. He did Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mission of taking the holy name to every town and village, and the very people who should have been appreciative, at least appreciative, if not downright helping, were the ones who criticized him off of the lines. What are you doing? Why are you training these people into Vaishnavas? Who are you? And Brahma said, you know, these people have no right to offer their advice. And he talks a little bit about Goswamis. He's saying that the people who appeared in Vodichananda's family and Dvaitacharya's family, so they're certainly devotees, but they should not criticize devotees who come from other families. And he said, and those Westerners who've been offered the title of Goswami should not think that they're superior to people who appeared in these Vaishnava families. Neither. He said there's no room for jealousy. So not on either side. And we see it going, you know, racism cuts both ways. Oh, we're Indian, you Westerners, you know, or we're Western, you Indians, you know. Go in both directions. And Prabhupada says if one has jealousy and he's a paramahamsa, he can fall down. This is, again, the essence, is this giving up of jealousy. I was thinking when reading this verse of a video that one devotee sent me recently of this man who was born, his father was a minister. He was born with no arms and no legs. And you have no idea how small somebody is if they have no legs. I mean, really no legs, completely, just right, you know. Because when I'm sitting, part of my height when I'm sitting is the top of my legs. So if I had no legs, I'd be about 4 inches shorter. And he has one little partial foot on one side, with about 3 toes, that comes directly out of his hip. And the two things you notice is, first of all, it's very hard not to stare at him. He seems like, well. And he himself has become a very religious person. He's become a very devout Christian. And what he does is he uses his deformity as a platform for his preaching. It's actually pretty amazing. He travels the world and he preaches to thousands or tens of thousands of people at a time. And he's standing up, stands up on a table. And he tells them, you know, if I can see my life as a blessing, and I can have an active, fulfilling life, and I can glorify God in my situation, what's wrong with you? You know, what kind of problems do you have? And they have films about how he gets through his day, you know, how he brushes his teeth, he has the toothbrush like nailed to something, and then he just puts his mouth on the toothbrush, and he has a brush nailed to something, he just puts his hair in the brush, and with his, I think he has three toes, he's a wonderful foot with three toes. With that, he can manipulate a computer mouse and a computer keyboard, and it works in the finance industry. But he's definitely a very religious person. I'd say he's definitely a Kanistha devotee. He's not a materialistic person. And yet he's completely deformed. In fact, he's using his deformity for preaching. As soon as people see him, they're like, whoa. And then he's very happy. He says, people wonder, how can he be so happy with that one? So similarly, Srila Prabhupada used all of us for preaching. He took his, at that time, mostly American disciples to India and had them get up and chant and dance. No, this body in general is a disqualification. Whatever body that you have, use it for preaching. There's some advantage to the body you have. If this guy found an advantage in preaching and having no arms and legs, I mean, really big, it's a huge advantage for him. He said how he used to pray that, you know, he'd wake up in the morning and just the arms and legs would sprout. He said, now I realize how actually I have a gift. So similarly, each of us, by our material circumstances, has some gift. Now, whatever it may be. You don't think, oh, you know, I have this really low situation, how can I be low? Whatever country you're from, whatever culture you're from, whatever gender we are, there's some way you can use that in Krishna service, and you can use it for preaching. And each of us have our unique attributes, even in terms of our body, that we can use in Krishna service. Now, we shouldn't be discriminating. We shouldn't say, Rupa Goswami is not giving levels of advancement. He's never given on the basis of the body. He doesn't say, someone from the Shudra family is a Kanistha, and you know, Vaishnava Kshatriya is a Jnana. It doesn't say, you know, if you're a woman, you're a Kanistha, and if you're a man, you're a Kanistha. So, not to judge people like that. Ultimately, what is the saying that we're looking for that we're sold? Is that a saying that you tend to trust people who are like us? But you know what? Everybody's like us. Because everybody's a soul. So, to practice seeing on that level. Now, sometimes I hear people say, well, we're not really on that level. So therefore, we have to, they're saying discriminate, but it ends up being, you know what I'm saying? It ends up being worse than that. Now, we're not on this transcendental level. Therefore, we're going to say, okay, these people can't do service because they have this kind of body. And it goes on in our Christian movement. It especially seems to go on in terms of gender. Somehow or other, you know, Prabhupada's making all these statements about caste, creed, birth, and somehow we look pretty good about that, but we're pretty bad about that. We haven't quite gotten that yet. No, they're different. They're other. No, those sort of people can't chant Hare Krishna, at least not loudly in public. So, what to say? But that's not the way we should be saying. Otherwise, if we continue to seem like that, then we perpetuate the bodily concept of life. Of course, we have to do different services. I was saying, use the body. You have to do service according to the body. Absolutely. Each of us have a body and mind that's suited for a particular service. So instead of seeing the body and mind as an impediment, see it as a vehicle for service. What kind of service is suitable for this body and mind? Right, and if you look, we'll just take a quick look at our map here of Texas. And these are all the different nodes, bodily defects, birth, even a parent's misbehavior. In the Janasandha and Sankachanda section of Bhakti Rotoka makes the point that a devotee who still hasn't developed proper behavior is better than a materialistic person who has proper behavior. At least they're going on the right path. That's not an excuse for improper behavior. We should be very kind. And, you know, as Jesus said, those of you without sin throw the first stone, so be careful. Who can say in this material world that we have no fault? And basically the reason that if we're not doing any sinful activity, that is through Krishna's protection. That's not due to our great strength. Krishna can bewilder anyone. He even bewildered Vajrayana. Right? Even bewildered Vajrayana. So many of us are subject to be bewildered. And if we criticize a devotee, then Krishna may look at us and say, oh, what about you? How are you here in this circumstance? How great do you think you are? Don't be careful. It's part of the envious mentality. Oh, this person is so fallen, this person is so fallen. A materialistic vision. And mistreatment of great devotee. We shouldn't mistreat anybody. If you really want to be on the safe side, they're just saying, okay, that's a good devotee. So be careful not to offend them, but those kids did so I can offend them. Why? Because they're all or even those people who are just materialists and mind bodies, never with an offensive mentality. We may have to point out the faults of materialistic persons in order for instruction, but not with an envious mentality, not with a critical mentality. Because ultimately, everybody's perfect. We don't know. We were telling the story of Guru Maharaj. We don't know who's going to be able to live the world. Who can say? So we're safe on those. In terms of criticism, we're safe if we criticize nobody and we offend nobody. We should give service, particularly to the intimate Lord, but we should not criticize anybody. All right. So, does anyone have some idea now that we've done as to why it is that if we follow this advice, we'd be free from all material distress? You'd be off the bodily concept of life, and all of our distress is due to the body. Don't be feeling that distress anymore, because I wouldn't be working and acting according to the body. Other reasons why we'd be free from, yes? Because this way would attract the mercy of the devotees of Krishna. Do you think Krishna would be happy with us if we dealt with people like this? Do you think he might want to associate with us? See, Krishna really wants to associate with us, at the same time he sort of doesn't right now, if we're not seeing him all the time. So any of us here who aren't seeing Krishna, Premantana Chaitya Bhakti Yojana, Sannyasa Daivara Dayasya Yojana, why aren't we seeing him? You know, he's there. He's right there, and he's there, and he's there, and he's there. And if we're not fully seeing him, that's because he's hiding, even though he so much wants to be with us. Why? Because he somehow doesn't really want to be with us, because he doesn't trust us. I told that story the other day, you know, about the little kid who put the oatmeal on the couch and had to go into the other room. But the same thing, you know, if you're hitting your brothers and sisters, you know, if they just started hitting Madhava, you'd put her in another room, and you'd say, you know, I'm not going to play with you right now until you're nice to your little brother. When you do that? I'm sorry, if you want to come be with me, you've got to be nice to your brother. There's a place in the Bible where it says, "He in Mato Manayam Shavada Yukayahat Anamushit Gopidu Pasa." How wonderful it is when brothers are sitting together in peace. And of course, we're reading about the Prachetas, now we're reading about the Prachetas sons and grandsons, how Lord Vishnu was so happy with their cooperation. So we're all like that. You teach, aren't you happy when your students are nice to each other? Right? It's natural. So Krishna also feels like that. So yeah, one way we get free of material distresses by following this is Krishna becomes happy with us. He likes to be with us. He says, yeah, I want to be with you. And he starts giving us his mercy, in which case we realize him. Once we realize him, we're in the truth. And once we're in the truth, we see that there's no such thing as distress. Not touching us at all. It has nothing to do with us and imagination. We become established in the truth. And the other way that doing these things frees us from material distress. So it gets us off the bottom platform, attracts Krishna's mercy. I don't have a preconceived list here, folks. Oh, okay. We avoid offenses, and offenses bring you direct reaction. Offenses against Vaishnava give you a much heavier reaction than just bad karma. So a lot of the suffering that we're undergoing, adiyatma, kadigaya, kadigotik, is due to past bad karma and also due to offenses. So that's on an external platform. And the mind is in distress when you're offensive too, isn't it? Is it a very happy feeling to be criticizing others and not getting along with others? No. Okay, why else would we avoid distresses? So now we have off the bottom platform, attract Krishna's mercy, be free from offenses, other reasons. We'll feel happy because we'll be seeing everybody connected with Krishna, ourselves and everybody. Yes. We'll have a lot more time and energy to talk about Krishna, which will make us very happy, and we'll forget all the material mysteries. So instead of spending our mental and verbal energy in things that are bad relationships, we'll be using that for Krishna. Okay. I'm thinking also that the opposite of all these things is again envy. And envy is what ties us to the material world. And when we become free from envy, then we start becoming established again in our natural position of soul. And on the position of soul, there is no misery. The distress we're experiencing is, in one sense, an illusion. It's something like someone who's watching a movie and they're crying because the hero in the movie got killed. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that we are not doing anything. He said, while we're sitting, eating, breathing, evacuating, we're just witnessing. These things are not really happening to us. So these distresses are not happening to us. Right, well, I hope you found this interesting. And I take 2 minutes if there's any general questions, and then we stop. And next week I have to stop at 9 sharp. That's a strict order. Yes? How do you not criticize others? Well, you can see the good in them. Focus on the good. You can focus on Krishna being happy. You can focus on the fact that you also have so many faults. How do we get rid of the propensity? Do you eat at the root of envy through our attentive engagement in devotional service? Therefore, this cannot be done until you follow the instructions of the first 3 verses. You can't do it. You could try to do it without fishing, but it's not going to last. We were talking about that with the 12th chapter, you know, having this equanimity of mind artificially doesn't last. So first you have to do the things in the first three verses. Obviously we're doing it all simultaneously. In other words, that has to be done. That we following the prescribed process of devotion, following the footsteps of the previous acharyas, not associating with envious people in an intimate way. As we control our mind and senses. Then I'll actually be able to cut out this critical propensity at the root. The real reason we have a critical propensity is that we want to have a critical propensity. We actively desire it. So the point of, as Krishna says in the 12th chapter, what is the purpose of Abhyasa Yoga? Is to develop desire. So the practice of Tat Karma is to develop a desire instead of to be envious and desire to please Krishna. So I can't cut out the root of something if I still want it. It's to shift my desire back to the origin. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much. And next week we will do 7 and 8, which is Shraddha to Prem.